Scenes at Marseille and Lyons. Marseille's Toulon and Lyons had declared themselves against the Jacobin supremacy. Rich from commerce and their maritime situation, and, in the case of Lyons, from their command of internal navigation, the wealthy merchants and manufacturers of those cities foresaw the total insecurity of property, and in consequence of their own ruin, in the system of arbitrary spoliation and murder upon which the government of the Jacobins was founded. But property, for which they were solicitous, though, if its natural force is used in time, the most powerful barrier to withstand revolution, becomes, after a certain period of delay, its helpless victim. If the rich are in due season liberal of their means, they have the power of enlisting in their cause, and as adherents, those among the lower orders, who, if they see their superiors dejected and despairing, will be tempted to consider them as objects of plunder. But this must be done early, or those who might be made the most active defenders of property will join with such as are prepared to make a prey of it. Marseille showed at once her goodwill and her impotency of means. The utmost exertions of that wealthy city, whose revolutionary band had contributed so much to the downfall of the monarchy in the attack on the Tuileries, were able to equip only a small and doubtful army of about 3,000 men, who were dispatched to the relief of Lyon. This inconsiderable army threw themselves into Avignon, and were defeated with the utmost ease by the Republican General Carteau, despicable as a military officer, and whose forces would not have stood a single engagement of Vendean sharpshooters. Marseille received the victors, and bowed her head to the subsequent horrors which it pleased Carteau, with two formidable Jacobins, Barras and Ferrand, to inflict on that flourishing city. The place underwent the usual terrors of Jacobin purification, and was for a time affectedly called Nameless Commune. Lyons made a more honorable stand. That noble city had been subjected for some time to the domination of Chalier, one of the most ferocious, and at the same time one of the most extravagantly absurd, of the Jacobins. He was at the head of a formidable club, which was worthy of being affiliated with the Mother Society, and ambitious of treading in its footsteps, and he was supported by a garrison of two revolutionary regiments, besides a numerous artillery, and a large addition of volunteers, amounting in all to about 10,000 men, forming what was called a revolutionary army. This Chalier was an apostate priest, an atheist, and a thorough-paced pupil in the School of Terror. He had been procureur of the community, and had imposed on the wealthy citizens a tax, which was raised from 6 to 30 millions of livres, but blood as well as gold was his object. The massacre of a few priests and aristocrats confined in the fortress of Pierre Six was a pitiful sacrifice, and Chalier, ambitious of deeds more decisive, caused a general arrest of 100 principal citizens, whom he destined as a hecatomb, more worthy of the demon whom he served. This sacrifice was prevented by the courage of the Lyonnois, a courage which, if assumed by the Parisians, might have prevented most of the horrors which disgraced the revolution. The meditated slaughter was already announced by Chalier to the Jacobin Club. 300 heads, he said, are marked for slaughter. Let us lose no time in seizing the members of the departmental office bearers, the presidents and secretaries of the sections, all the local authorities who obstruct our revolutionary measures. Let us make one faggot of the whole, and deliver them at once to the guillotine. But ere he could execute his threat, terror was awakened into the courage of despair. The citizens rose in arms and besieged the Hotel de Ville, in which Chalier, with his revolutionary troops, made a desperate and for some time a successful, yet ultimately a vain defense. But the Lyonnois unhappily knew not how to avail themselves of their triumph. They were not sufficiently aware of the nature of the vengeance which they had provoked, or of the necessity of supporting the bold step which they had taken, by measures which precluded a compromise. Their resistance to the violence and atrocity of the Jacobins had no political character, any more than that offered by the traveller against robbers who threaten him with plunder and murder. They were not sufficiently aware that, having done so much, they must necessarily do more. They ought, by declaring themselves royalists, to have endeavored to prevail on the troops of Savoy, if not on the Swiss, who had embraced a species of neutrality which, after the 10th of August, was dishonorable to their ancient reputation, to send in all haste soldiery to the assistance of a city which had no fortifications or regular troops to defend it, but which possessed, nevertheless, treasures to pay their auxiliaries, and strong hands and able officers to avail themselves of the localities of their situation, which, when well defended, are sometimes as formidable as the regular protection erected by scientific engineers. The people of Lyon vainly endeavored to establish a revolutionary character for themselves upon the system of Gironde, two of whose prescribed deputies tried to draw them over to their unpopular and hopeless cause, and they inconsistently sought protection by affecting a republican zeal, even while resisting the decrees and defeating the troops of the Jacobins. There were undoubtedly many of royalist principles among the insurgents, and some of their leaders were decidedly such, but these were not numerous or influential enough to establish the true principle of open resistance and the ultimate chance of rescue by a bold proclamation of the king's interest. They still appealed to the convention as their legitimate sovereign, in whose eyes they endeavored to vindicate themselves, and at the same time tried to secure the interest of two Jacobin deputies, who had countenanced every violation attempted by Chalier, that they might prevail upon them to represent their conduct favorably. Of course, they had enough of promises to this effect, while Messrs. Gautier and Nioche, the deputies in question, remained in their power. Promises doubtless the more readily given that the Lyonnois, though desirous to conciliate the favor of the convention, did not hesitate in proceeding to the punishment of the Jacobin Chalier. He was condemned and executed along with one of his principal associates termed Reard. To defend these vigorous proceedings, the unhappy insurgents placed themselves under the interim government of a council who, still desirous to temporize and maintain the revolutionary character, termed themselves the Popular and Republican Commission of Public Safety of the Department of the Rhine and Loire, a title which, while it excited no popular enthusiasm and attracted no foreign aid, no ways soothed, but rather exasperated, the resentment of the convention, now under the absolute domination of the Jacobins, by whom everything short of complete fraternization was accounted presumptuous defiance. Those who were not with them, it was their policy to hold as their most decided enemies. The Lyonnois had indeed letters of encouragement and promised concurrence from several departments, but no effectual support was ever directed to their city, excepting the petty reinforcement from Marseille, which we have seen was intercepted and dispersed with little trouble by the Jacobin general Carteau. Lyons had expected to become the patroness and focus of an anti-Jacobin league formed by the great commercial towns against Paris and the predominant part of the convention. She found herself isolated and unsupported, and left to oppose her own proper forces and means of defense, to an army of 60,000 men, and to the numerous Jacobins contained within her own walls. About the end of July, after a lapse of an interval of 2 months, a regular blockade was formed around the city, and in the first week of August, hostilities took place. The besieging army was directed in its military character by General Kellerman, who, with other distinguished soldiers, had now begun to hold an eminent rank in the Republican armies, but for the purpose of executing the vengeance for which they thirsted, the Jacobins relied chiefly on the exertions of the deputies they had sent along with the commander, and especially of the representative, Dubois-Crance, a man whose sole merit appears to have been his frantic Jacobinism. General Percy, formerly an officer in the royal service, undertook the almost hopeless task of defense, and by forming redoubts on the most commanding situations around the town, commenced a resistance against the immensely superior force of the besiegers, which was honorable if it could have been useful. The Lyonnois, at the same time, still endeavored to make fair weather with the besieging army by representing themselves as firm Republicans. They celebrated as a public festival the anniversary of the 10th of August, while Dubois-Crance, to show the credit he gave them for their Republican zeal, fixed the same day for commencing his fire on the place and caused the first gun to be discharged by his own concubine, a female born in Lyon's bombs, and red-hot bullets were next resorted to against the second city of the French Empire, while the besieged sustained the attack with a constancy and on many parts repelled it with a courage highly honorable to their character. But their fate was determined. The deputies announced to the convention their purpose of pouring their instruments of havoc on every quarter of the town at once, and when it was on fire in several places, to attempt a general storm. The city, they said, must surrender, or there shall not remain one stone upon another, and this we hope to accomplish in spite of the suggestions of false compassion. Do not then be surprised when you hear that Lyons exists no longer. The fury of the attack threatened to make good these promises. The sufferings of the citizens became intolerable. Several quarters of the city were on fire at the same time. Immense magazines were burnt to the ground, and a loss incurred during 2 nights' bombardment, which was calculated at 200 millions of livres. A black flag was hoisted by the besieged on the great hospital, as a sign that the fire of the assailants should not be directed on that asylum of hopeless misery. The signal seemed only to draw the Republican bombs to the spot where they could create the most frightful distresses and outrage in the highest degree the feelings of humanity. The devastations of famine were soon added to those of slaughter, and after 2 months of such horrors had been sustained, it became obvious that farther resistance was impossible. The paralytic Couthon, with Collot d'Herbois and other deputies, were sent to Lyon by the Committee of Public Safety to execute the vengeance which the Jacobins demanded, while Dubois-Crance was recalled for having put, it was thought, less energy to his proceedings than the prosecution of the siege required. Collot d'Herbois had a personal motive of a singular nature for delighting in the task entrusted to him and his colleagues. In his capacity of a play actor, he had been hissed from the stage at Lyons, and the door to revenge was now open. The instructions of this committee enjoined them to take the most satisfactory revenge for the death of Chalière and the insurrection of Lyons, not merely on the citizens but on the town itself. The principal streets and buildings were to be leveled with the ground, and a monument erected where they stood was to record the cause. Lyons rebelled against the Republic. Lyons is no more. Such fragments of the town as might be permitted to remain were to bear the name of Villefranchi. It will scarce be believed that a doom like that, which might have passed the lips of some eastern despot, in all the frantic madness of arbitrary power and utter ignorance, could have been seriously pronounced and as seriously enforced in one of the most civilized nations in Europe, and that to the present enlightened age men who pretended to wisdom and philosophy should have considered the labors of the architect as a proper subject of punishment. So it was, however, and to give the demolition more effect, the impotent Couthon was carried from house to house, devoting each to ruin, by striking the door with a silver hammer and pronouncing these words, "House of a rebel, I condemn thee in the name of the law." Workmen followed in great multitudes, who executed the sentence by pulling the house down to the foundations. This wanton demolition continued for 6 months, and is said to have been carried on at an expense equal to that which the superb military hospital, the Hôtel des Invalides, cost its founder, Louis XIV. But Republican vengeance did not waste itself exclusively upon senseless lime and stone. It sought out sentient victims. The deserved death of Chalière had been atoned by an apotheosis executed after Lyons had surrendered, but Collot d'Herbois declared that every drop of that patriotic blood fell as if scalding his own heart, and that the murder demanded atonement. All ordinary process and every usual mode of execution was thought too tardy to avenge the death of a Jacobin proconsul. The judges of the Revolutionary Commission were worn out with fatigue, the arm of the executioner was weary, the very steel of the guillotine was blunted. Collot d'Herbois devised a more summary mode of slaughter. A number of from 200 to 300 victims at once were dragged from prison to the Place de Botteau, one of the largest squares in Lyon, and there subjected to a fire of grape shot. Efficacious as this mode of execution may seem, it was neither speedy nor merciful. The sufferers fell to the ground like singed flies, mutilated but not slain, and imploring their executioners to dispatch them speedily. This was done with sabers and bayonets, and with such haste and zeal that some of the jailers and assistants were slain along with those whom they had assisted in dragging to death, and the mistake was not discerned, until, upon counting the dead bodies, the military murderers found them to amount to more than the destined tale. The bodies of the dead were thrown into the Rhône to carry news of the Republican vengeance, as Collot d'Herbois expressed himself, to Toulon, then also in a state of revolt. But the sullen stream rejected the office imposed on it, and headed back the dead in heaps upon the banks, and the Committee of Representatives was compelled at length to allow the relics of their cruelty to be interred, to prevent the risk of contagion. The installation of the Goddess of Reason. At length, the zeal of the infuriated atheists in France hurried them to the perpetration of one of the most ridiculous, and at the same time impious transactions which ever disgraced the annals of any nation. It was no less than a formal renunciation of the existence of a supreme being and the installation of the Goddess of Reason in 1793. "There is," says Scott, "a fanaticism of atheism as well as of superstitious belief, and a philosopher can harbor and express as much malice against those who persevere in believing what he is pleased to denounce as unworthy of credence, as an ignorant and bigoted priest can bear against a man who cannot yield faith to dogmata which he thinks insufficiently proved." Accordingly, the throne being totally annihilated, it appeared to the philosophers of the school of Hébert, who was author of the most gross and beastly periodical paper of the time, called the Père Duchesne, that in totally destroying such vestiges of religion and public worship as were still retained by the people of France, there was room for a splendid triumph of liberal opinions. It was not enough, they said, for a regenerate nation to have dethroned earthly kings, unless she stretched out the arm of defiance towards those powers which superstition had represented as reigning over boundless space. An unhappy man named Gobet, constitutional bishop of Paris, was brought forward to play the principal part in the most impudent and scandalous farce ever acted in the face of a national representation. It is said that the leaders of the scene had some difficulty in inducing the bishop to comply with the task assigned him, which, after all, he executed, not without present tears and subsequent remorse, but he did play the part prescribed. He was brought forward in full procession to declare to the convention that the religion which he had taught so many years was, in every respect, a piece of priestcraft, which had no foundation either in history or sacred truth. He disowned, in solemn and explicit terms, the existence of the deity to whose worship he had been consecrated, and devoted himself in future to the homage of liberty, equality, virtue, and morality. He then laid on the table his episcopal decorations, and received a fraternal embrace from the president of the convention. Several apostate priests followed the example of this prelate. The gold and silver plate of the churches was seized upon and desecrated. Processions entered the convention, travestied in priestly garments, and singing the most profane hymns, while many of the chalices and sacred vessels were applied by Chaumette and Hébert to the celebration of their own impious orgies. The world, for the first time, heard an assembly of men, born and educated in civilization, and assuming the right to govern one of the finest of the European nations, uplift their united voice to deny the most solemn truth which man's soul receives, and renounce unanimously the belief and worship of a deity. For a short time, the same mad profanity continued to be acted upon. One of the ceremonies of this insane time stands unrivaled for absurdity, combined with impiety. The doors of the convention were thrown open to a band of musicians, preceded by whom the members of the municipal body entered in solemn procession, singing a hymn in praise of liberty, and escorting, as the object of their future worship, a veiled female whom they termed the Goddess of Reason. Being brought within the bar, she was unveiled with great form and placed on the right hand of the president. When she was generally recognized as a dancing girl of the opera, with whose charms most of the persons present were acquainted from her appearance on the stage, while the experience of individuals was farther extended. To this person, as the fittest representative of that reason whom they worshipped, the National Convention of France rendered public homage. This impious and ridiculous mummery had a certain fashion, and the installation of the Goddess of Reason was renewed and imitated throughout the nation, in such places where the inhabitants desired to show themselves equal to all the heights of the revolution. The churches were, in most districts of France, closed against priests and worshippers. The bells were broken and cast into cannon, the whole ecclesiastical establishment destroyed, and the republican inscription over the cemeteries declaring death to be perpetual sleep announced to those who lived under that dominion that they were to hope no redress even in the next world. Intimately connected with these laws affecting religion was that which reduced the union of marriage, the most sacred engagement which human beings can form, and the permanence of which leads most strongly to the consolidation of society, to the state of a mere civil contract of a transitory character, which any two persons might engage in, and cast loose at pleasure, when their taste was changed, or their appetite gratified, if fiends had set themselves to work, to discover a mode of most effectually destroying whatever is venerable, graceful, or permanent in domestic life, and of obtaining at the same time an assurance that the mischief which it was their object to create should be perpetuated from one generation to another, they could not have invented a more effectual plan than the degradation of marriage into a state of mere occasional cohabitation, or licensed concubinage. Sophie Arnoult, an actress famous for the witty things she said, described the republican marriage as the sacrament of adultery. Fall of Danton, Robespierre, Marat, and other Jacobins. These monsters fell victims by the same means they had used for the destruction of others. Marat was poignarded in 1793 by Charlotte Corday, a young female who had cherished in a feeling between lunacy and heroism the ambition of ridding the world of a tyrant. Danton was guillotined in 1794. Robespierre followed soon after. His fall is thus described by Scott in his Life of Napoleon. At length his fate urged him on to the encounter. Robespierre descended to the convention, where he had of late but rarely appeared, like the far nobler dictator of Rome, and in his case also a band of senators was ready to poignard the tyrant on the spot, had they not been afraid of the popularity he was supposed to enjoy, and which they feared might render them instant victims to the revenge of the Jacobins. The speech which Robespierre addressed to the convention was as menacing as the first distant rustle of the hurricane, and dark and lurid as the eclipse which announces its approach. Anxious murmurs had been heard among the populace who filled the tribunes or crowded the entrances of the hall of the convention, indicating that a second 31st of May, being the day on which the Jacobins proscribed the Girondists, was about to witness a similar operation. The first theme of the gloomy orator was the display of his own virtues and his services as a patriot, distinguishing as enemies to their country all whose opinions were contrary to his own. He then reviewed successively the various departments of the government, and loaded them in turn with censure and contempt. He declaimed against the supineness of the committees of public safety and public security, as if the guillotine had never been in exercise, and he accused the Committee of Finance of having counter-revolutionized the revenues of the Republic. He enlarged with no less bitterness on withdrawing the artillerymen, always violent Jacobins, from Paris, and on the mode of management adopted in the conquered countries of Belgium. It seemed as if he wished to collect within the same lists all the functionaries of the state, and in the same breath to utter defiance to them all. The usual honorary motion was made to print the discourse, but then the storm of opposition broke forth, and many speakers vociferously demanded that before so far adopting the grave inculpations which it contained, the discourse should be referred to the two committees. Robespierre, in his turn, exclaimed that this was subjecting his speech to the partial criticism and revision of the very parties whom he had accused. Exculpations and defences were heard on all sides against the charges which had been thus sweepingly brought forward, and there were many deputies who complained in no obscure terms of individual tyranny and of a conspiracy on foot to outlaw and murder such part of the convention as might be disposed to offer resistance. Robespierre was but feebly supported, save by Saint-Just, Couthon, and by his own brother. After a stormy debate, in which the convention were alternately swayed by their fear and their hatred of Robespierre, the discourse was finally referred to the committees, instead of being printed. And the haughty and sullen dictator saw in the open slight thus put on his measures and opinions the sure mark of his approaching fall. He carried his complaints to the Jacobin Club to repose, as he expressed it, his patriotic sorrows in their virtuous bosoms, where alone he hoped to find succor and sympathy. To this partial audience he renewed, in a tone of yet greater audacity, the complaints with which he had loaded every branch of the government and the representative body itself. He reminded those around him of various heroic eras, when their presence and their pikes had decided the votes of the trembling deputies. He reminded them of their pristine actions of revolutionary vigor, asked them if they had forgot the road to the convention, and concluded by pathetically assuring them that if they forsook him, he stood resigned to his fate, and they should behold with what courage he would drink the fatal hemlock. The artist David caught him by the hand as he closed, exclaiming in rapture at his elocution, "I will drink it with thee." The distinguished painter has been reproached as having on the subsequent day declined the pledge which he seemed so eagerly to embrace, but there were many of his original opinion at the time he expressed it so boldly, and had Robespierre possessed either military talents or even decided courage, there was nothing to have prevented him from placing himself that very night at the head of a desperate insurrection of the Jacobins and their followers. Payan, the successor of Hébert, actually proposed that the Jacobins should instantly march against the two committees, which Robespierre charged with being the focus of the anti-revolutionary machinations, surprise their handful of guards, and stifle the evil with which the state was menaced, even in the very cradle. This plan was deemed too hazardous to be adopted, although it was one of those sudden and master strokes of policy which Machiavel would have recommended. The fire of the Jacobins spent itself in tumult and threatening, and in expelling from the bosom of their society Collot d'Herbois, Tallien, and about 30 other deputies of the Mountain Party whom they considered as specially leagued to effect the downfall of Robespierre, and whom they drove from their society with execration and even blows. Collot d'Herbois, thus outraged, went straight from the meeting of the Jacobins to the place where the Committee of Public Safety was still sitting, in consultation on the report which they had to make to the convention the next day upon the speech of Robespierre Saint-Just, one of their number, though warmly attached to the dictator, had been entrusted by the committee with the delicate task of drawing up that report. It was a step towards reconciliation. But the entrance of Collot d'Herbois, frantic with the insults he had received, broke off all hope of accommodation betwixt the friends of Danton, and those of Robespierre d'Herbois exhausted himself in threats against Saint-Just, Couthon, and their master Robespierre, and they parted on terms of mortal and avowed enmity. Every exertion now was used by the associated conspirators against the power of Robespierre to collect and combine against him the whole forces of the convention, to alarm the deputies of the plain with fears for themselves, and to awaken the rage of the mountaineers, against whose throat the dictator now waved the sword, which their short-sighted policy had placed in his hands. Lists of prescribed deputies were handed around, said to have been copied from the tablets of the dictator. Genuine or false, they obtained universal credit and currency, and these whose names stood on the fatal scrolls engaged themselves for protection in the league against their enemy. The opinion that his fall could not be delayed now became general. This sentiment was so commonly entertained in Paris on the 9th Thermidor, or 27th July, that a herd of about 80 victims, who were in the act of being dragged to the guillotine, were nearly saved by means of it. The people, in a generous burst of compassion, began to gather in crowds and interrupted the melancholy procession, as if the power which presided over these hideous exhibitions had already been deprived of energy, but the hour was not come. The vile Henriette, commandant of the National Guards, came up with fresh forces also on the day destined to be the last of his own life, proved the means of carrying to execution this crowd of unhappy and doubtless innocent persons. On this eventful day, Robespierre arrived in the convention and beheld the mountain in close array and completely manned, while, as in the case of Catiline, the bench on which he himself was accustomed to sit seemed purposely deserted. Saint-Just, Couthon, Lebas, his brother-in-law, and the younger Robespierre were the only deputies of name who stood prepared to support him. But could he make an effectual struggle, he might depend upon the aid of the servile Barrère, a sort of Belial in the convention, the meanest yet not the least able amongst those fallen spirits, who, with great adroitness and ingenuity, as well as wit and eloquence, caught opportunities as they arose and was eminently dexterous in being always strong upon the strongest, and safe upon the safest side. There was a tolerably numerous party ready, in time so dangerous to attach themselves to Barrère, as a leader who professed to guide them to safety if not to honour. And it was the existence of this vacillating and uncertain body, whose ultimate motions could never be calculated upon, which rendered it impossible to presage with assurance the event of any debate in the convention during this dangerous period. Saint-Just arose in the name of the Committee of Public Safety to make, after his own manner, not theirs, a report on the discourse of Robespierre on the previous evening. He had begun a harangue in the tone of his patron, declaring that, were the tribune which he occupied the Tarpeian rock itself, he would not the less, placed as he stood there, discharge the duties of a patriot. I am about, he said, to lift the veil. I tear it asunder, said Tallien, interrupting him. The public interest is sacrificed by individuals, who come hither exclusively in their own name, and conduct themselves as superior to the whole convention. He forced Saint-Just from the tribune, and a violent debate ensued. Below, Varennes called the attention of the assembly to the sitting of the Jacobin Club on the preceding evening. He declared the military force of Paris was placed under the command of Henriette, a traitor and a parricide who was ready to march the soldiers whom he commanded against the convention. He denounced Robespierre himself as a second Catiline, artful as well as ambitious, whose system it had been to nurse jealousies and inflame dissensions in the convention, so as to disunite parties and even individuals from each other, attack them in detail, and thus destroy those antagonists separately, upon whose combined and united strength he dared not have looked. The convention echoed with applause every violent expression of the orator, and when Robespierre sprung to the tribune, his voice was drowned by a general shout of, "Down with the tyrant!" Tallien moved the denunciation of Robespierre with the arrest of Henriette, his staff officers, and of others connected with the meditated violence on the convention. He had undertaken to lead the attack upon the tyrant, he said, and to poignard him in the convention itself if the members did not show courage enough to enforce the law against him. With these words, he brandished an unsheathed poignard, as if about to make his purpose good. Robespierre still struggled hard to obtain audience, but the tribune was adjudged to Barrère, and the part taken against the fallen dictator by that versatile and self-interested statesman was the most absolute sign that his overthrow was irrecoverable. Torrents of invective were now uttered from every quarter of the hall, against him whose single word was wont to hush it into silence. This scene was dreadful, yet not without its use to those who may be disposed to look at it as an extraordinary crisis, in which human passions were brought so singularly into collision, while the vaults of the hall echoed with exclamations from those who had hitherto been the accomplices, the flatterers, the followers, at least the timid and overawed assentors to the dethroned demagogue. He himself, breathless, foaming, exhausted, like the hunter of classical antiquity when on the point of being overpowered and torn to pieces by his own hounds, tried in vain to raise those screech owl notes by which the convention had formerly been terrified and put to silence, he appealed for a hearing from the president of the assembly to the various parties of which it was composed. Rejected by the mountaineers, his former associates, who now headed the clamour against him, he applied to the Girondists, few and feeble as they were, and to the more numerous but equally helpless deputies of the plain, with whom they sheltered. The former shook him from them with disgust, the last with horror. It was in vain he reminded individuals that he had spared their lives, while at his mercy this might have been applied to every member in the House, to every man in France. For who was it during 2 years that had lived on other terms than under Robespierre's permission? And deeply must he internally have regretted the clemency, as he might term it, which had left so many with ungashed throats to bay at him. But his agitated and repeated appeals were repulsed by some with indignation, by others with sullen or embarrassed and timid silence. A British historian might say that even Robespierre ought to have been heard in his defence, and that such calmness would have done honour to the convention and dignified their final sentence of condemnation as it was. They no doubt treated the guilty individual according to his deserts, but they fell short of that regularity and manly staidness of conduct which was due to themselves and to the law, and which would have given to the punishment of the demagogue the effect and weight of a solemn and deliberate sentence, in place of its seeming the result of the hasty and precipitate seizure of a temporary advantage. Haste was, however, necessary, and must have appeared more so at such a crisis than perhaps it really was. Much must be pardoned to the terrors of the moment, the horrid character of the culprit, and the necessity of hurrying to a decisive conclusion. We have been told that his last audible words, contending against the exclamations of hundreds and the bell which the president was ringing incessantly, had uttered in the highest tones which despair could give to a voice naturally shrill and discordant, dwelt long on the memory, and haunted the dreams of many who heard him. "President of assassins," he screamed. "For the last time, I demand privilege of speech." After this exertion, his breath became short and faint, and while he still uttered broken murmurs and hoarse ejaculations, the members of the mountain called out that the blood of Danton choked his voice. The tumult was closed by a decree of arrest against Robespierre, his brother, Couthon, and Saint-Just. Le Bas was included on his own motion, and indeed could scarce have escaped the fate of his brother-in-law, though his conduct then and subsequently showed more energy than that of the others. Couthon, hugging in his bosom the spaniel upon which he was wont to exhaust the overflowing of his affected sensibility, appealed to his decrepitude, and asked whether, maimed of proportion and activity as he was, he could be suspected of nourishing plans of violence or ambition. "Wretch," said Legendre, "thou hast the strength of Hercules for the perpetration of crime. Dumas, president of the Revolutionary Tribunal, with Henriot, commandant of the National Guards, and other satellites of Robespierre, were included in the doom of arrest. The convention had declared their sitting permanent, and had taken all precautions for appealing for protection to the large mass of citizens who, wearied out by the reign of terror, were desirous to close it at all hazards. They quickly had deputations from several of the neighboring sections, declaring their adherence to the national representatives in whose defense they were arming, and, many undoubtedly prepared beforehand, were marching in all haste to the protection of the convention. But they heard also the less pleasing tidings, that Henriot, having effected the dispersion of those citizens who had obstructed, as elsewhere mentioned, the execution of the 80 condemned persons and consummated that final act of murder, was approaching the Tuileries, where they had held their sitting, with a numerous staff, and such of the Jacobinical forces as could hastily be collected. Happily for the convention, this commandant of the National Guards, on whose presence of mind and courage the fate of France perhaps for the moment depended, was as stupid and cowardly as he was brutally ferocious, he suffered himself without resistance to be arrested by a few gendarmes, the immediate guards of the convention, headed by two of its members who behaved in the emergency with equal prudence and spirit. But fortune or the demon whom he had served afforded Robespierre another chance for safety, perhaps even for empire. For moments which a man of self-possession might have employed for escape, one of desperate courage might have used for victory, which, considering the divided and extremely unsettled state of the capital, was likely to be gained by the boldest competitor. The arrested deputies had been carried from one prison to another, all the jailers refusing to receive under their official charge Robespierre, and those who had aided him in supplying their dark habitations with such a tide of successive inhabitants. At length the prisoners were secured in the office of the Committee of Public Safety. But by this time, all was in alarm amongst the Commune of Paris, where Fleuriot the mayor and Payan the successor of Hébert convoked the civic body, dispatched municipal officers to raise the city and the faubourgs in their name, and caused the tocsin to be rung. Payan speedily assembled a force sufficient to liberate Henriette Robespierre and the other arrested deputies, and to carry them to the Hôtel de Ville, where about 2,000 men were congregated, consisting chiefly of artillerymen and of insurgents from the suburb of Saint-Antoine, who already expressed their resolution of marching against the convention. But the selfish and cowardly character of Robespierre was unfit for such a crisis. He appeared altogether confounded and overwhelmed with what had passed and was passing around him, and not one of all the victims of the Reign of Terror felt its disabling influence so completely as he, the despot who had so long directed its sway. He had not, even though the means must have been in his power, the presence of mind to disperse money in considerable sums, which of itself would not have failed to ensure the support of the revolutionary rabble. Meantime, the convention continued to maintain the bold and commanding front which they had so suddenly and critically assumed. Upon learning the escape of the arrested deputies and hearing of the insurrection at the Hôtel de Ville, they instantly passed a decree outlawing Robespierre and his associates, inflicting a similar doom upon the mayor of Paris, the procureur, and other members of the Commune, and charging 12 of their members, the boldest that could be selected, to proceed with the armed force to the execution of the sentence. The drums of the National Guards now beat to arms in all the sections under authority of the convention, while the tocsin continued to summon assistance with its iron voice to Robespierre and the civic magistrates. Everything appeared to threaten a violent catastrophe, until it was seen clearly that the public voice, and especially amongst the National Guards, was declaring itself generally against the terrorists. The Hôtel de Ville was surrounded by about 1,500 men, and cannon turned upon the doors. The force of the assailants was weakest in point of number, but their leaders were men of spirit, and night concealed their inferiority of force. The deputies commissioned for the purpose read the decree of the assembly to those whom they found assembled in front of the city hall, and they shrunk from the attempt of defending it, some joining the assailants, others laying down their arms and dispersing. Meantime, the deserted group of terrorists within conducted themselves like scorpions, which, when surrounded by a circle of fire, are said to turn their stings on each other and on themselves. Mutual and ferocious upbraiding took place among these miserable men. "Wretch, were these the means you promised to furnish?" said Payan to Henriette, whom he found intoxicated and incapable of resolution or exertion, and seizing on him as he spoke, he precipitated the revolutionary general from a window. Henriette survived the fall only to drag himself into a drain, in which he was afterwards discovered and brought out to execution. The younger Robespierre threw himself from the window but had not the good fortune to perish on the spot. It seemed as if even the melancholy fate of suicide, the last refuge of guilt and despair, was denied to men who had so long refused every species of mercy to their fellow creatures. Lebay alone had calmness enough to dispatch himself with a pistol shot. Saint Just, after imploring his comrades to kill him, attempted his own life with an irresolute hand, and failed. Couthon lay beneath the table brandishing a knife, with which he repeatedly wounded his bosom without daring to add force enough to reach his heart. Their chief, Robespierre, in an unsuccessful attempt to shoot himself, had only inflicted a horrible fracture on his underjaw. In this situation they were found like wolves in their lair, foul with blood, mutilated, despairing, and yet not able to die. Robespierre lay on a table in an anteroom, his head supported by a deal box, and his hideous countenance half hidden by a bloody and dirty cloth bound round the shattered chin. The captives were carried in triumph to the convention, who, without admitting them to the bar, ordered them, as outlaws, for instant execution. As the fatal cars passed to the guillotine, those who filled them, but especially Robespierre, were overwhelmed with execrations from the friends and relatives of victims whom he had sent on the same melancholy road, the nature of his previous wound, from which the cloth had never been removed till the executioner tore it off, added to the torture of the sufferer. The shattered jaw dropped, and the wretch yelled aloud to the horror of the spectators. A mask taken from that dreadful head was long exhibited in different nations of Europe, and appalled the spectator by its ugliness and the mixture of fiendish expression with that of bodily agony. Thus fell Maximilian Robespierre, after having been the first person in the French Republic for nearly 2 years, during which time he governed it upon the principles of Nero or Caligula. His elevation to the situation which he held involved more contradictions than perhaps attached to any similar event in history. A low-born and low-minded tyrant was permitted to rule with the rod of the most frightful despotism, a people whose anxiety for liberty had shortly before rendered them unable to endure the rule of a humane and lawful sovereign. A dastardly coward arose to the command of one of the bravest nations in the world, and it was under the auspices of a man who dared scarce fire a pistol that the greatest generals in France began their careers of conquest. He had neither eloquence nor imagination, but substituted in their stead a miserable, affected, bombastic style, which, until other circumstances gave him consequence, drew on him general ridicule. Yet against so poor an orator, all the eloquence of the philosophical Girondists, all the terrible powers of his associate Danton, employed in a popular assembly, could not enable them to make an effectual resistance. It may seem trifling to mention that in a nation where a good deal of prepossession is excited by amiable manners and beauty of external appearance, the person who ascended to the highest power was not only ill-looking but singularly mean in person, awkward and constrained in his address, ignorant how to set about pleasing even when he most desired to give pleasure, and as tiresome nearly as he was odious and heartless. To compensate all these deficiencies, Robespierre had but an insatiable ambition, founded on a vanity which made him think himself capable of filling the highest situation, and therefore gave him daring, when to dare is frequently to achieve. He mixed a false and overstrained but rather fluent species of bombastic composition with the grossest flattery to the lowest classes of the people, in consideration of which they could not but receive as genuine the praises which he always bestowed on himself. His prudent resolution to be satisfied with possessing the essence of power without seeming to desire its rank and trappings formed another art of cajoling the multitude. His watchful envy, his long-protracted but sure revenge, his craft, which to vulgar minds supplies the place of wisdom, were his only means of competing with his distinguished antagonists, and it seems to have been a merited punishment of the extravagances and abuses of the French Revolution that it engaged the country in a state of anarchy which permitted a wretch such as we have described to be for a long period master of her destiny. Blood was his element like that of the other terrorists, and he never fastened with so much pleasure on a new victim, as when he was at the same time an ancient associate in an epitaph, of which the following couplet may serve as a translation. His life was represented as incompatible with the existence of the human race. Here lies Robespierre, let no tear be shed. Reader, if he had lived, thou hadst been dead. The fall of Robespierre ended the reign of terror. Most of the leaders who had acted a conspicuous part in these horrid scenes met a doom similar to that of their leaders. It is impossible to convey to the reader any adequate conception of the atrocities committed in France during this gloomy period. In the name of liberty, men, women, and children were involved in the massacres which took place at the instigation of the Jacobin chiefs. Hundreds of both sexes were thrown into the Loire, and this was called Republican marriage and Republican baptism. And it should never be forgotten that it was not till France as a nation had denied the existence of a deity and the validity of his institutions that she was visited by such terrible calamities, let it be burnt in on the memory of every generation, that such is the legitimate tendency of infidel opinions. They first destroy the conscience, blunt the moral sense, harden the heart, and wither up all the social and kindly affections, and then their votaries are ripe for any deed of wickedness within the possibility of accomplishment by human agency. Says an eloquent writer, when the Sabbath was abolished in France, the mighty God whose being they had denied and whose worship they abolished stood aloof and gave them up, and a scene of proscription and assassination and desolation ensued, unparalleled in the annals of the civilized world. In the city of Paris, there were in 1803 807 suicides and murders among the criminals executed. There were 7 fathers who had poisoned their children, 10 husbands who had murdered their wives, 6 wives who had poisoned their husbands, and 15 children who had destroyed their parents. It may be profitable here to record the end of several other Jacobin leaders who had been conspicuous during these scenes of atrocity and bloodshed. Public opinion demanded that some of the most obnoxious members should be condemned. After hesitating for some time, at length the convention, pressed by shame on the one side and fear on the other, saw the necessity of some active measure, and appointed a commission to consider and report upon the conduct of the 4 most obnoxious Jacobin chiefs, Collot d'Herbois, Billaud Varennes, Vadier, and Barrère. The report was of course unfavorable, yet upon the case being considered, the convention were satisfied to condemn them to transportation to Cayenne. Some resistance was offered to this sentence, so mild in proportion to what those who underwent it had been in the habit of inflicting. But it was borne down, and the sentence was carried into execution. Collot d'Herbois, the demolisher and depopulator of Lyons, is said to have died in the common hospital, in consequence of drinking off at once a whole bottle of ardent spirits. Billaud Varennes spent his time in teaching the innocent parrots of Guiana the frightful jargon of the Revolutionary Committee, and finally perished in misery. These men both belong to that class of atheists, who, looking up towards heaven, loudly and literally defied the deity to make his existence known by launching his thunderbolts. Miracles are not wrought on the challenge of a blasphemer more than on the demand of a skeptic, but both these unhappy men had probably before their death reason to confess that in abandoning the wicked to their own free will, a greater penalty results even in this life than if Providence had been pleased to inflict the immediate doom which they had impiously defied. Encouraged by the success of this decisive measure, the government proceeded against some of the terrorists whom they had hitherto spared, but whose fate was now determined, in order to strike dismay into their party. 6 Jacobins, accounted among the most ferocious of the class, were arrested and delivered up to be tried by a military commission. They were all deputies of the Mountain Gang. Certain of their doom, they adopted a desperate resolution. Among the whole party they possessed but one knife, but they resolved it should serve them all for the purpose of suicide. The instant their sentence was pronounced, one stabbed himself with this weapon, another snatched the knife from his companion's dying hand, plunged it in his own bosom and handed it to the third, who imitated the dreadful example. Such was the consternation of the attendants, that no one arrested the fatal progress of the weapon. All fell either dead or desperately wounded. The last were dispatched by the guillotine. After this decisive victory and last dreadful catastrophe, Jacobinism, considered as a pure and unmixed party, can scarce be said to have again raised its head in France, although its leaven has gone to qualify and characterize in some degree more than one of the different parties which have succeeded them. As a political sect, the Jacobins can be compared to none that ever existed, for none but themselves ever thought of an organized, regular, and continued system of murdering and plundering the rich, that they might debauch the poor by the distribution of their spoils. They bear, however, some resemblance to the frantic followers of John of Leyden and Nipperdoling, who occupied Munster in the 17th century and committed, in the name of religion, the same frantic horrors which the French Jacobins did in that of freedom. In both cases, the courses adopted by these parties were most foreign to and inconsistent with the alleged motives of their conduct. The Anabaptists practiced every species of vice and cruelty by the dictates, they said, of inspiration. The Jacobins imprisoned 300,000 of their countrymen in the name of liberty, and put to death more than half the number under the sanction of fraternity. Footnotes. The Queen made the following animated speech to the troops assembled at Tilbury. My loving people, we have been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety, to take heed how we commit ourselves to armed multitudes, for fear of treachery. But I assure you, I do not desire to live to distrust my faithful and loving people. Let tyrants fear, I have always so behaved myself that under God, I have placed my chiefest strength and safeguard in the loyal hearts and goodwill of my subjects. And therefore I am come among you at this time, not as for my recreation or sport, but being resolved in the midst and heat of the battle, to live or die among you all, to lay down for my God, and for my kingdom, and for my people, my honour and my blood, Even in the dust I know I have but the body of a weak and feeble woman. But I have the heart of a king, and of a king of England too. And think foul scorn that Parma, or Spain, or any prince of Europe, should dare to invade the borders of my realms, to which rather than any dishonour should grow by me, I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general, judge and rewarder of every one of your virtues in the field. I know already by your forwardness that you have deserved rewards and crowns, and I do assure you on the word of a prince, they shall be duly paid you. In the meantime, my lieutenant general shall be in my stead, than whom never prince commanded a more noble and worthy subject, not doubting by your obedience to my general, by your concord in the camp, and your valour in the field, we shall shortly have a famous victory over those enemies of my God, of my kingdom, and of my people.
Be afterward Charles the First,
sake. Although Garnet was convicted for this horrible crime, yet the bigoted papists were so besotted as to look upon him as an object of devotion. They fancied that miracles were wrought by his blood, and regarded him as a martyr. Such is the deadening and perverting influence of popery. To the King of England was at that time called Highness, not Majesty, as at present. When the papists received these books as of equal divine authority with the books of the Old Testament, ed. Fee, this he actually proposed, but the patriarch would not listen to the proposal a moment. G. He causeth all to receive a mark, etc., and no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark or the name of the beast. The patriarch was also clothed in scarlet, like the woman on the scarlet-coloured beast. Shan, see Revelation 13:13. And when he first came to Beirut, this same sentence was dictated to him, and it appeared in his eyes so much like blasphemy that he refused to write it. We afterwards ascertained that he was decoyed off to a distance as if for walk, and when he would have returned, was prevented by force. K. This letter was a mere tissue of testimonies brought from the fathers and from the scriptures condemning the worship of images.